This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about cohabiting relationships and separation. This is our part two of cohabitation and separation podcasts, so please do listen to our part one. I am here today with Miss Sarah Cooper from Thomas More Chambers in Lincoln's Inn in London. As well as being a highly experienced and senior barrister in family law, Sarah specialises in complex international family cases. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
That's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Hattie.
And I just want to say before we go into our questions that our listeners' statistics as of this week have shown that we are listened to now in 15 different countries and 83 different cities.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal. So it just goes to show that this topic is not necessarily only interesting people that live in the UK, but clearly people that live abroad. And perhaps we can look at covering that in another podcast.
Well, I'd love to help you on that one. Yes, absolutely.
Because that's another really broad subject. But for our listeners, I just want to mention that in Cohabiting Relationships and Separation Part 1 podcast that we've already uploaded, the seven questions that we discussed in that podcast was, what is meant by common law husband and wife? Cohabitation after living together for a number of years. Your rights over a property if your partner is a sole owner of a house and you split up. How to best avoid problems if you move in with somebody and you are not married. What is a cohabitation agreement? Are they legally binding? Rights for engaged couples. And then at the end of the podcast, we touched on parental rights out of marriage over my children. So today we're going to start with a very, very common question that we're certainly asked, Sarah, is do I have to pay child support if I'm not married to the mother of the child? Now, understandably, that's normally asked by the male, the man, the father, where the relationship has broken down, they're not married, and he moves out and she says, I want maintenance, and he says, well, I don't know, and probably I don't have to pay you. What's the position there? Because statistics say that over 47% of children, and this is 2016, so going back 4 years from now, were born outside of marriage or civil partnership. That's actually a huge number. I know we covered some statistics in part one, but that's almost half of children born.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it's no doubt for that reason that way back at the start, when we had the Children Act 1989, that in fact that piece of legislation never differentiated between children born to parents who were married and children born to parents who are not married. So really, as far as the eyes of the law is concerned, what is important is whether or not you are the biological parent, as far as a financial obligation is concerned. And also, there are some cases, it's worth saying, where if you have treated a child as your own, so for example, you are effectively the step parent, there may also be some situations where you might also have a financial obligation to a child. But certainly in a straightforward situation where you are the biological parent, yes, you are going to have a financial obligation.
So yes, indeed, you can be brought to pay child support even if you're not married parents. And I just want to ask a question here because it is another very commonly asked question. What about if you're not on the birth certificate of the child?
Well, that's not...
Because we're saying biological, which means you're biologically the parent. We're not. But what about if you're not, if the mother went and registered the child, didn't put you on the birth certificate, are you still obligated as the man, let's say, to pay child support. Does that have any different, make any difference?
It's not going to have a huge amount of difference, because in the courts there can be provision for DNA testing if there is any question mark about whether or not a person is or is not the parent biologically. So no, the starting point will always be that there is a financial obligation regardless of whether or not you are or you are not on the birth certificate.
Yes, because that's a big myth where people say, oh, I thought if I wasn't on the birth certificate, then I'll have no financial obligation. I don't know whether that was ever the case, but that seems to be a myth out there amongst people, that the mother rushes off if separation has happened prior to the birth of a child to put the father on, because she thinks, well, that's going to mean that he's legally the father. But we're saying no, biologically is enough.
Yes, and also most applications for child maintenance are dealt with by a government institution called the Child Maintenance Service, and the CMS itself also has provisions for DNA testing if necessary.
That's interesting. I didn't know they actually went that far. I know there's an online calculator, so if you're sitting there thinking, how much child maintenance could I get through the help of this government department called the CMS, you could go online and use a calculator.
Yes,
of some form.
That's right.
But you can also prosecute, actually. You could also take the parent to court privately, couldn't you, to try and get a higher child maintenance than what the CMS may award, what the government...
Well, the CMS is quite a complicated institution. And the way that child maintenance works in this jurisdiction is that we have the CMS, which deals with the vast majority of cases, but it has limits. So it will not deal with cases where a parent earns, I think it's more than around £150,000 a year. And it will not deal in general with cases where either the child or the payer is not living in this jurisdiction. So when you have, if you think you might fall into one of those categories, you really are going to need quite specific legal advice, because certainly in relation to cases where, for example, a father is living overseas, generally, the CMS wouldn't have jurisdiction, but it does in certain cases. Equally, if you're dealing with a case where you believe that the father is earning a lot of money, again, you would need to be careful before just making an application to the court rather than going to the CMS. So those are areas where you would need to take some detailed legal advice
specific to your situation.
Absolutely.
What we mean by this jurisdiction is within the UK. That's
we actually mean within England and Wales.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, so the next commonly asked question is, how do I claim child support if the father of the child lives in another country, or if I live in another country and with the child and the father lives here? And that's where we're looking at
the
complex.
Those generally would not be claims that you can bring via the Child Maintenance Service, although
the government department that could assist.
Although, as I say, there are some circumstances in which they might be able to assist, such as an example, you know, if a father is working for the armed forces and happens to be posted overseas for a short period of time. That might be a classic example. So again, you would need to take some quite careful advice. But if that weren't the case, then we have another piece of legislation which is part of the Children Act from 1989, and it's provisions at Schedule 1. And Schedule 1 of the Children Act allows cohabiting and unmarried parents to apply for financial support, but only if they cannot go via the CMS. So there is a very complicated overlap between the CMS and Schedule 1. And if you're in doubt, you must take independent legal advice. But there certainly are various cases where, for example, a father who lives overseas has been ordered to pay sums by a court within Schedule 1 of the Children Act. There may, of course, then be issues about the enforcement of such an order.
So if they don't pay and you think, right, I need to enforce this order now, how would you do it?
Well, again, that is complicated. There is another body called REMO, the Reciprocal Enforcement of Maintenance Orders, and it is a complex area of the law. But if the payer is living in a jurisdiction in relation to which there is an agreement with the United Kingdom in relation to the enforcement of maintenance, then it should be possible, via the various technical and legal procedures that exist, to enforce that maintenance order.
Right, right. But I mean, you know, everybody's situations are very unique to them, and this is a very broadly speaking outline of,
yes,
you know, what
absolutely
the position could be. So we're saying, look, there is hope to collect child maintenance if the parent of the child lives abroad, but it's very specific to your situation.
And specific to the country in which they're living in.
Yes.
I think that no doubt listeners would... a key piece of information for them would be that most of the countries in the Middle East, where obviously there are lots of British expats living and working, those countries are very unlikely to enforce any maintenance order.
Made in the UK.
Yes.
Right, right. Okay. All right, very interesting. The next question, Sarah, is, can I claim a higher amount of child support if the father of the child is a high earner? Now, we touched on if there's £150,000 earning, say the father of the child earns more than £150,000, the CMS will not take that on to try, not take that case on to try and collect and go after the parent for child support. So are you expected, is one expected then to make a private court application for child support?
Yes, the way it works is that the CMS has to do the assessment first of all. So an application has to be made to the CMS, even if you are dealing with somebody who you understand to be earning millions. So they then have to make the application, consider the application, make the assessment, and then on the basis that the CMS have accepted that the income is over whatever their statutory limit is, you are then given a free option and an avenue to go straight to the court and ask for what we call top-up maintenance under Schedule 1. But again, the overlap between the CMS and applications to the court is a complicated area.
Because say if, and really breaking this down, say if as an individual the parent that you're trying to claim child maintenance from is earning £100,000,
yes,
and has that's a very sensible of a high earner, and you think, well, I'm not happy with accepting a smaller amount. I want to go privately through the court system to try and get more child maintenance in the situation where you're not a married couple. Can you not do that then, unless you go over the threshold of the CMS?
Well, the way that the legislation works means that for general day-to-day maintenance, you are not permitted to make an application for maintenance unless the CMS have already declared, essentially, that the payer is over their statutory limit. However, you can make other claims to the court under Schedule 1, one of which is for private school fees even if the main maintenance claim is with the CMS by reason of how much the other parent is likely to be earning, you can also make claims under Schedule 1, even if the main maintenance claim is with the CMS, in relation to lump sums or provision of accommodation. But what you cannot do is make a sort of a general maintenance claim.
Just say,
unless...
X amount.
No.
You have to be specific in only specific areas, like you've mentioned. Private schooling, housing, or for a specific,
yes,
specific need. For example, where the father says, well, I'm paying child maintenance, I'm not interested in paying any more, perhaps.
Well, you know, it might be for a specific lump sum, such as refurnishing costs of the accommodation that was ordered to be provided.
Yeah.
It's a complicated area. As I've said, this overlap between the CMS and the courts catches out a number of people and a number of lawyers.
No, it's interesting because I know there's, I know there has been changes that have come in to play with what and how you can do, but a lot of people don't actually know that the CMS exists and don't actually know that they can make an application for child maintenance support through a government body that will assess them, assist them and get that process started. Most people think that actually the first, the starting position is you go to court to get child maintenance because that's the general theory and the consensus of it all, and there are lots of myths attached to child maintenance and child support. Lots of people think that if they're not married they can get maintenance for themselves as the main carer for the child and things like that. So this is a huge area, and I think every situation is different. I think we'll further go on to perhaps on that question in further future podcasts to discuss, you know, parents that hide their income in order to not pay child maintenance. We've had lots of cases like that and they've been very, very interesting. So I think that would be another area to look at within that question.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's worth saying that the Child Maintenance Service finds it terribly difficult to assess maintenance when people are self-employed, particularly where they're running their own companies, because some people may artificially depress the income they take out of their company. So there are all sorts of complicated issues around that assessment by the Child Maintenance Service.
Well, I think an interesting podcast would be to talk to the Child Maintenance Service and discuss their processes to some degree, because say, do they have all the resources to really weed out those people that are cheating the system or cheating their partner for the sake of, I mean, you know, I'd be very interested to find that out because, you know, they're, at the end of the day, they're a government funded body that may have a restriction of resources or allocation of money to allocate to, you know, these kind of things. And I don't know how open they would be to someone saying, well, I will bring you the evidence if you will then go after that person for the money. I'll bring you evidence of their income, or I don't know how much of that they can do.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, they are obviously restricted by their resources, but the more evidence they're provided with, you know, the more likely they are to act
and succeed. And one of the interesting things I find about the Child Maintenance Service is that when you make your application, when you say, I'm making an application for child maintenance from the parent that, you know, I'm no longer with, but is the biological parent to my child, the application goes in from that date. So if they are successful in saying X, right, the father, or very rarely it'll be the mother, but the parent that it's being claimed from must pay, for argument's sake, £100 a week, that payment goes back to the date that you made the application.
Yes.
Which is because the, you know, the process of actually deciding how much the parent should pay and things like that take a very long time, weeks, months sometimes. So that's very helpful, I think, when you finally do get this, and hopefully the parent pays. I mean, that's all, you know, has to go hand in hand with that. But all right, so let's move on to our next question, Sarah, which sadly will probably be our last question for today, is to protect my interest in a property, what steps should I take legally if I'm buying a property with a partner that I'm not married to and I'm not really planning to get married to within the immediate future?
Well, when two people, whoever they might be, whether they're in a relationship or they're not in a relationship, an intimate relationship. So say, Hattie, you and I, we go into a solicitor's office and we say we'd like to buy a property. Sensible conveyancing solicitors should be talking to both of us about the need for independent legal advice. Because if we both go in together, you might say, well, I'd like the whole of the property in my name. And I might say, gosh, no, I want 50% of it in my name. So you can see that from the point of view of the conveyancing solicitor, there may be a bit of a conflict. So the first thing to think about for anyone buying a property with another person is, do you need independent legal advice? Because there are ways of protecting your position. Firstly, in relation to whose name is going to be on the land registry itself. And secondly, in relation to what we call trust documents, which might show what proportions the property is held in. You see, if you and I buy a property together, Hattie, we could buy either as tenants in common, in which case there would be an assumption that we hold 50-50, or we could buy as joint tenants. But if we buy as joint tenants, we might have a separate trust document, and it could say that you have 60% and I have 40%. So there are all sorts of possibilities, which are obviously entirely dependent on our circumstances, what we've actually agreed, and also to some extent who's put what money in.
Yes.
But having said that, you and I could put in equal amounts and we might still agree in a trust document to hold it 70%, 30% for some reason or another. So the really key issue is, before you sign the documentation on the conveyance, have you had independent legal advice if you're buying a property with somebody else? Because there are ways to protect yourself.
Yes, and then you can explain, well, actually, we're in a relationship, we're going to own it equally because of whatever agreement you have, whether it's like you say, you've put the money down equally, or whether you've agreed that even though the money hasn't got, deposit money hasn't gone in equally, you know, you might have, and it's very common, parents lending money to one of you, or a family member lending money to one of you for you to buy that property. So you want to protect them as well. And naturally, I find more and more that parents are very apprehensive about giving their children lump sums of money to go and buy a property with their boyfriends or girlfriends, because if the relationship doesn't work out, naturally that the parents want to protect the money that they've put into the, you know, put into the property.
Well, I think it's worth saying that if anyone's making or going to advance large amounts of money to a purchase by other people, they should also be taking independent legal advice.
Having a trust
document. Because a grandparent, well, it may not be necessarily having a trust document drawn up, it may be having a loan document drawn up, because it may be the case that actually the money is not a gift. It may be the case that the money is a loan. There are lots of possibilities. But again, for anyone who is going to advance monies, whether it's to their child or to somebody else, you need to think about this before the conveyance is completed.
Yes, I mean,
and you need to take proper advice as to how best to protect your position.
What we have often is where parents are lending money to a child to go and buy a property with their partner, and the agreement is that once the when the property gets sold one day and they're free to sell it whenever they're ready to do so, that money in its original form, I mean, I don't know, some families may want interest on it, most tend not to, goes back to the lending parents.
The difficulty, my experience over 25 years, is that unfortunately people don't write down what the agreement was.
And they have very vague memories when things go wrong.
Yes, and it's only when then their child separates from their partner that people then, as it were, take a position as to whether the monies advanced were a gift. And if so, who were they a gift to? Were they a gift just to their child, or a gift to both
to
of them?
Sarah, isn't it? I mean,
well, it is after the event.
Exactly.
But Hattie, it's very easy to put in place beforehand.
Yes.
Very easy.
Yes.
So I want to be clear to all of your listeners that actually drawing up some type of document and having it signed by all of the people involved in the transaction, not just your child, but by their partner as well, as to what the intention was, if you are going to provide some money to your child.
And also, I mean, if that's not the case, and you and as we said, you're buying a property with somebody, you know, there's this stigma attached, isn't there, to people putting together legal documents to do with situations like that, because naturally it's a very lovely time, especially if it's your first property and you're going to buy a property with somebody. It's incredibly exciting. It's one of the biggest purchases you can make, really.
Yes.
Buying a property, although it's more likely to be mortgaged in most cases. And when one partner rolls up and says, look, I think we need to sign a legal document, I've seen relationships fall apart because of that. And they don't actually even get to buy the property because there's a stigma attached. And there shouldn't be, should there? Because it's to protect everybody involved.
Well, to be honest,
there is that stigma attached to it, though.
Given that you rightly identify that it's probably most people's largest purchase,
yes,
and that in order to buy a property in this country, you're going to need a lawyer in any event,
yes,
really, the best advice I can give all your listeners is to just take another few minutes and think about the agreement between yourself and the other purchaser.
And write it down, have it written down in a trust document or in a document, like you say, where everybody signs it. It's crystal clear what's been agreed.
Absolutely.
Everyone has a copy, you know, and off you go.
Otherwise, you're only going to make more work for people like me in the future.
I like that very much. Yes. Well, thank you very much, Sarah. This has been yet another very, very informative podcast, and I certainly look forward to us recording part three. So don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you very much for listening.
Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes.